Hey friends, we got a really exciting announcement this week, and hopefully you've already heard about it. Hopefully you've already seen it. But this week we launched a brand new website, and we're so excited about it. It was created by our friends over at Whiteboard, and we had some help shooting the video from our videographer, Joseph Schlabs. So huge shout out to those guys. Thank you guys so much for creating such an amazing website. We're excited about it. We want you guys to be excited about it. So go online, check it out at thecamphouse.com.
Joe Bonamassa, which is a great, you know, blues guitarist, came up not long ago. The Gibson factory brought him up. And because the Gibson and Fender factories, you know, we have more of their history than they do. They didn't document this stuff.
Oh, it's incredible.
So Gibson brought Joe Bonamassa up, and he went into the back where we kind of have an upgrade experience and just lost his mind. He goes, this is where every custom color Firebird in the world is. No wonder I can't find one.
Johnny Smith is the president and CEO of the Songbirds Guitar Museum, a new addition to the Southside District on the famous Chattanooga-Choo-Choo campus. As the name indicates, the museum is dedicated to one of the most important cultural artifacts and technological creations of the 20th century, the guitar. But as you will learn, this is not just any collection of guitars, but the most exclusive collection of rare guitars in the world. And it sits right here in our city.
This is the Camp House Podcast, and I am your host, Matt Busby.
Johnny, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
It's a pleasure to talk to you. I think I get to see Johnny maybe three times a year, and you know, there's always a smile on your face. Like, you're one of the happiest guys I know.
Well, thanks, man. I'm blessed. I'm in a good position. I have no reason to frown.
You know, today we're here to talk about the new Songbirds Museum, and Johnny's played a key part in creating that here in Chattanooga and bringing that to Chattanooga. But before, you know, before we get there, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself? Are you from Chattanooga?
I am. I'm from Chattanooga. Well, I guess we always say Chattanooga, but I was originally kind of raised on Sand Mountain in Ider, Alabama, a little small town, northeast Alabama. But it's so close to Chattanooga, we've always called it Chattanooga, I guess. So was raised there, and my father was a pastor, and we just ended up in Alabama. And the next thing you know, everybody worked in Chattanooga, and it was just easier for us to come down here and, you know, work and things like that. So I've been in Chattanooga my entire life, except for a few moments where I lived in Nashville playing music, and then I was in Asheville, North Carolina for a little bit. But other than that, Chattanooga's home.
Yeah, you have a huge background with music, and now you're in charge of this new Songbirds Guitar Museum.
Yeah.
But you're not a guitarist, correct?
I'm not. I always make a joke about that because Leo Fender, who created the guitar, the electric guitar as we know it today in 1950, was not a guitarist either, which is kind of always surprised with that. He was an engineer and created this thing and used his other executives to help him out with the playing part of it. So I always say it takes a non-guitarist to run a guitar museum or even build a guitar.
Talk about the museum. You know, how did this idea, how long has this idea been going through your head and in your partner's head, everybody who's been a part of this?
Yeah.
Because I know you've been talking about this for a while. Mm-hmm. And take us through that story.
Well, it's been born and basically went away and was born again, went away, and then I think this is the third incarnation of trying to make the idea. So our organization group has a collection of vintage guitars, and we work with other affiliates that have access to some of the most incredible, you know, fretted electric guitars and pre-war acoustic guitars, mandolin, banjos, you know, et cetera, in the world. And there was just a cumulative idea that said, you know, what would it look like if we put all these into an exhibit and let people see how the guitar impacted history and impacted music, which music impacted culture and so forth. So we started it 4 years ago, and we looked at different partnerships in Chattanooga on how to maybe make it work here. We also looked at other cities. I mean, man, I went to Seattle, Austin, New York, Nashville, of course. I mean, I was all over the country just trying to figure out, you know, from a business standpoint, where is the population that would support something like this? And, you know, it worked out kind of, you know, ironically, after two complete, you know, projections of performance and what it would look like and what the investment would be like. And then, you know, the idea not really getting any traction beyond an idea to the point that we met with Adam Kinsey one day down at the Chattanooga Choo Choo. And he had a facility that he was thinking about trying to redo. And this idea, by the way, started 4 years ago. Yeah. So we really got to deciding to make it happen about a year and a half ago.
Okay.
Maybe a little bit longer than that, but roughly, let's say a year and a half. And it started because the idea was pretty much dead again. And Adam showed us this great facility at the Choo Choo, and then he showed us kind of like some of the plans and the ideas about expanding.
Right, because this is when they were expanding Revelry Room.
Yeah. Revelry Room was just coming in. I don't think Stir was in yet. Obviously, the Frothy Monkey was just an idea. The space was just an idea for a restaurant. The Frothy Monkey hadn't come in yet. The city was, entertaining, redoing the street, which was 14th Street, I think, originally, which now it's Station Street, you know, to kind of fall in with the brand. And we looked at this space and just thought it might be cool. And we'd already looked at the numbers for Chattanooga, and, you know, it didn't make as much sense to do it here. But I got to give the CVB credit with Bob Doak and, you know, Mary Howard Aid and Candace and all those folks over there. They started realizing that Chattanooga can be more than just an outdoors destination. And so they've done a lot, especially Mary Howard has done a lot to kind of promote the local music scene. Obviously, you guys, the Camp House. You know, the Revelry Room coming in, Track 29 doing well, Ashley Capps kind of, you know, booking some of these more city municipal auditoriums. And we saw that the population that loves music here is pretty substantial.
Right, yeah.
And so maybe with our geographic location, been in between the five cities, you know, the Birmingham's, the Huntsville, Nashville,
perfect
Knoxville.
Perfect middle location.
It is, man. And, you know, so you go to Nashville and be another cool thing, or you can come to Chattanooga and maybe be one of the coolest things that has to do with music and entertainment in town. I think Adam Kinsey jokingly called us the Aquarium of the South Side the other day, and I hope that that proclamation becomes true.
Yeah, that'd be amazing.
It would be. So, you know, we just went after it, got Thomas Palmer at Cogent Studios, you know, who's done the Flying Squirrel and the Feed and pretty much anything cool in town, you know, he's been involved with. You know, got him to work with it. Made by Tiny Giant, which is Michael Mahaffey and Matt Adams. Those guys are just on another level as far as, like, creativity goes, and they created this brand for us. And the name, and you know, so many other partners like Range Fabrication came in, and we let them specify what the cases would look like. Everything's proprietary design for us. We didn't deal with any national companies. We put $4 million into this project in the local economy.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
that's wonderful.
Yeah, there's not anyone that's involved with this from a creative standpoint that's not from Chattanooga.
Yeah.
All the contractors, T.G. Edwards, which is Ty Edwards, and then his general contractor, David Thornburg, and Michael Thornburg, his son, was our site supervisor. We got to be brothers over the years, and over the year, you know, we went for it without all the studies and things like that we'd done in the past for other cities. We just kind of went for it here. And so now we've got 530 guitars in there.
Okay.
I think we promised 300.
Wow.
So we went to over 500. And the way it's set up is you go through a timeline. It starts basically when you come in, we've got a huge LED wall. It's 16 feet long and 9 feet tall, and it kind of gives you an introductory video to where you are in the Choo Choo, which, if you think about it, how many musicians traveled on that train?
That was fascinating.
That was the source of travel, especially when these guitars were, you know,
used.
Being used.
Yeah.
And so I've thought about that many times. I wonder how the guitars could tell the story, maybe riding the Choo Choo. But, you know, this big video wall leads you into an idea of what you're about to see. And then you go into from 1950 through 59, and then you have another section that's 60 through 69, and then you have the 70s. And that's really kind of where the vintage guitar world lives. Now, prior to that, you obviously have acoustics and pre-war instruments, which I say pre-war because that defines a really significant era in American history. They didn't have electric guitars before then, so it's a lot of acoustics, a lot of banjos. And the electric guitar started in 1950. Leo Fender, and there's some incarnations before that, but in popularity, 1950, Leo Fender introduced a guitar called an Esquire.
Who's an engineer, he's not a musician.
Not a musician, he's an engineer, exactly. So he created this solid body electric guitar, you know, that you could plug into an amplifier. And the thing that changed is prior to 1950, the guitar was not the lead instrument in the band. It was actually in the background. We've got a video of Glenn Miller's song, The Chattanooga Choo Choo, plays on our big video wall down there. And the guitar player's in the back of the band, and he's just a timekeeper. He had no way to project his instrument. You know, there was not an amplifier.
Yeah.
So the horns, it was the saxophone, was really the lead guitar in the band, the clarinets and things like that. So the music was really swing music. So in 1950, when this guitar was created, a lot of paradigm shift happened. One thing that was important is TV was now coming into households, right? So now you had a way to distribute music versus radio, or you going out and buying music and playing it on your record player. Now you have music in your household with shows and programming coming on. This electrified guitar changed everything because now you have electric guitar player, electric bass player, and a drummer. Mm-hmm. And it created a new sound, and it was called rock and roll.
Yeah.
So, and that became very popular. I mean, if you think about you know, the Buddy Hollies of the world and the Carl Perkins, and I'm just trying to name big names, you know, that were out at that period. It changed everything. And so it changed culture, and the fact that these guys, now you could see what they look like, you know, without having to look at the cover of the record. you could latch onto their stardom and the way that they dressed. Their political opinions mattered, and so society changed. If you think about it, you know, the Ed Sullivan Show wouldn't even show Elvis Presley from his waist down because he was doing those wiggling dance moves, you know, that were so sexual. Nobody danced like that before him. You know, everybody used to have these choreographed dance steps with the swing music, and now this rock and roll just makes your body move in a different way, right? And so everybody thought it was the devil's music. I mean, think about it. At the time, it was crazy. It would not have existed without the guitar. And so we try and show you beautiful, you know, exhibits that start and kind of tell you that story that start in the timeline section, start in 1950. So you see actual guitars from that time frame that are all pretty much in original condition. And when I say pretty much, they all are original with the exception of some might have the strings changed, and some we've even got with the original strings on.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
holy
so
cow.
You'll see memorabilia from that era. It'll take you through the, in the 50s, it's my favorite era. The guitar came out as the Esquire in 1950. They shortly changed it to the Broadcaster. The Esquire has one bridge pickup. The Broadcaster came out with two pickups, so it's got a neck pickup and a bridge, which made the guitar sound a little different. People really liked it. That was 1950. The problem was is Fred Gretsch also made a drum kit called the Broadcaster, and so Leo Fender, in response to Fred Gretsch's letter that said your copyright infringement on our trademark, is, you know, the sticker, and still to this day the logo for Fender is a sticker on the headstock, and so he just went up and cut Broadcaster off of it in late 1950. So they call that guitar affectionately a no-caster, right? But the Broadcaster was actually named the Broadcaster because it broadcast over airwaves, you know, like a television or radio or whatever. So then it went to the no-caster, which didn't have a name, and then shortly after it came out with the Telecaster. Same body style, same exact looking guitar. And there's people played the Telecaster for years, all their life, and they have no idea why it's called the Telecaster. And one of the things is it derives from Broadcaster. Broadcasting, Telecaster's television.
Okay.
So it's the television guitar.
Yeah.
Telecaster. And so that was a really...
It's just too simple to put that together.
I know, and nobody really even thinks about it. But if you know, that's one of the things I want to get across, is you can play this instrument for 30 years and you have no idea why it's called what it's called.
Right.
You just take it for granted. So in 52, that was 1950, 51 and 52, you've got the Les Paul came out. So the Gibson Guitar Company got an electric guitar game. Big deal. And they made more of a gentleman's guitar. It had binding. If you look at their logo, it's embossed in the headstock, and you know, they have fret markers that are inlays. I mean,
and you have some of these original guitars.
Oh, yeah, they're all
in
original.
There.
Yeah, everything's original. So, like I said, there's 530 that take you through the time period. So the Gibson, what I thought was really cool about that is they painted them all gold. They wanted them all gold, so they call them the gold tops. You know, that's what guys are familiar with. But nobody ever thinks, well, why did they paint them all gold? It was because Les Paul said they were the gold standard of guitars, and so he wanted them all painted gold. And so, you know, later in 54, you had the Stratocaster, and we just kind of take you the invention of that. We take you through that whole timeline. It's just some cool stuff. And in the 50s, by the way, and even into the 60s, they did not make guitars of color at all. So the Telecaster was just like a simple wood, natural wood guitar with a black pickguard. The Stratocaster came out in a two-tone sunburst. That was the only way they were made. So if you had a guitar that was red, black, yellow, green, it doesn't matter. They were all special order guitars, not as a factory option, but you had to be special or know someone, and they would get automotive paints from DuPont and paint those guitars with automotive paint. If you see one real true early custom color guitar in your life, you've seen something pretty special, because they're just super rare. I'm going to show you 200.
Okay, I was going to say, so you have some of these.
Yeah,
then.
So I have over 200. It's pretty much the entire rainbow. And Joe Bonamassa, which is a great, you know, blues guitarist, came up not long ago. The Gibson factory brought him up, and because the Gibson and Fender factories, you know, we have more of their history than they do. They didn't document this stuff.
Oh, that's incredible.
So Gibson brought Joe Bonamassa up, and he went into the back where we kind of have an upgrade experience, and just lost his mind. He goes, this is where every custom color Firebird in the world is. No wonder I can't find one.
Well, okay, so I mean, you're talking us through the way the tour is going to work, and I want to keep doing that. But I also, I don't know how we make this clear to people, like how unique and revolutionary this museum is.
Yeah.
For the music scene in Chattanooga, and what this means to the music world, not here, not even in the U.S.
You're right,
but like on a global level, how special this place is.
It's kind of hard to give it.
Have you figured out how to communicate that yet?
You know, I haven't, because it's almost like trying to explain something that's a phenomenon. You know, it's almost like you have to see it to believe it. And now, obviously,
it's like religious experience.
It is, man. It is a religious experience to a certain degree. You know, it's just the history of the instrument is so incredible, and the rarity and the value of these things are just completely out of control. And you know, to see you can go places like, you know, Country Music Hall of Fame, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, etc., and you'll see some great historic instruments that some people played. Let me back up. I said historical instruments that people played. They're historical in the sense that maybe somebody touched them, but the instrument itself is not that historic. You know, they might have made thousands of that particular guitar. It's just a particular person played this one. So I guess that's cool in a sense, but, you know, what we're showing is the earliest examples, I mean, that are incredibly rare, that maybe a third shift employee at Fender decided they wanted to do something with special appointments or make it different, you know, and they did. But it's not that it's just one of one. It's one of like 200 manufactured total. These things were handmade. And so you think about these were tools. These were tools for guys to go and play at their gigs. They just didn't survive. And so to see them preserved and to think about what this instrument meant to history is really cool. Now, to think about whose hands might have touched it, that's cool as well. But to me, it's more about the substance of the instrument. There's not a collection like this. I mean, like I said, even the manufacturers, Fender and Gibson, have both visited and have been completely blown away. They're wanting to actually study some of the guitars to see some of their manufacturing processes of that period.
Yeah, oh, that's fascinating.
Because they don't have them, you know? And, I mean, they just sold the guitars. Think about it, in the 50s, you know, they weren't keeping computer record documents of these things.
Yeah.
And so it's really neat to American history, in my opinion, because, I mean, this is all American-made items. They were done in very, very low numbers. They were very experimental. And just to see the cultural change that they made from the time that they started to now is quite different. I mean, they didn't have CNC machines to cut these bodies out perfectly. It was guitars that just were different, man. They were literally handmade, and to think that they survived. And there's some that are in mint condition, some have been played, and to be honest with you, the ones that have been played the most and loved on are the ones that I appreciate the most, you know, because I just love to see what they could tell me. You know, some of the cases will have stickers. We've got some cases on display down there as well that the guitars came in that's got stickers from just all over the world, and it was like, you know, you can't even find out who owned the guitar, but it's killing me because I want to know more about it. So it's really just a place to let your imagination go a little bit crazy and just, you know, and I think that's part of, I think that's part of the experience, you know?
Yeah. So I know, within the museum itself, you actually do have a special room in this museum. Tell me about that room.
Yeah. It's really, there's a couple of rooms. There's an upgraded experience that we did. And listen, we're not trying to just like get people to, you know, pay us more money to do things. It's, you know, but we wanted to have an upgrade ability for us to put several things on display. I mean, if you're a guitar enthusiast, you're going to love if you don't do that part. But, you know, at the same time, if you want to see some things that are particularly special, I mean, some just really wild one-offs, what we'll do is you can do an upgrade and you'll take a tour guide at that point. The rest of the exhibit is kind of like go at your own leisure. You can, we have some iPads out and there's information in the cases. And, you know, we kind of leave it up to you to take your story away, you know, from whatever you've experienced. But if you really want to, you know, have a more personal one-on-one experience, we take you to a back area that we it's just the all-access pass that goes into a large green room area. We call it that because it can actually host shows or special events or whatever you want to do. It holds like 80 people.
Kids' birthday parties,
anything you want, corporate events, which we're doing that. And then in the back we have the vault, and it's a kind of like a third layer. But the upgrade includes the green room and the vault. And the vault is the guitars don't have any memorabilia around them. They don't. They're just there on their own because I think they're regal enough to stand alone. And the guitar expert that takes you back will spend as much time with you as you want. You know, and if somebody's really having a great time and we see that and are enjoying what we're doing, as long as you don't have a big belt buckle on and a big ring, you never know. We might take one of them out, put it in your hands, and let's crank it up, you know. So we really want that to be a personal takeaway that's pretty incredible. And, you know, so we offer, like, you know, memberships and all access passes in different levels and scales and things. So we try to make it affordable. It's just $15 to come into the main area. So it's and you can spend, I mean, gosh, I've seen people spend all day in there so far, you know, but you can buzz through it and leave in an hour if you want. And, you know, you can come back later in the same day, or you can buy an all access pass, which is really affordable, and come back and check it out. So it's unbelievable, really.
So you guys have about 530 guitars in there right now, but I know you have plans for rotating exhibits and that kind of thing. Like, what's the plan as far as switching out some of these guitars and that kind of thing?
Yeah.
Like, how often are you guys going to change the setup in there?
Well, you know, luckily we've got about double what we already have in there in waiting. And so I wish I could show you 1500 guitars, because I think they're all cool. But, you know, the idea is right now about every 4 months to change at least parts of the exhibit in both areas. So if you're doing the all access, you'll see a new exhibit back there. And in the main area, I think the timeline is something that's really important to stay, because, you know, there's such an enormous amount of history in there. We can change some things out, I think, to reveal that better, but for the most part, that might stay fixed. But about every 4 months, in some of the breakout cases that we have, which we feature surf guitars, banjos, acoustic instruments, Vince Gill, which is our ambassador right now. We've aligned with Vince quite well, and he's an amazing guy. He's got a case that he's curated that's in there. We've done a British Invasion case that shows some of the guitars. It was really important to that era. And so all those things can change out. We're hoping to do them at least every 4 months. Yeah. You know, so you got quite a bit of flavor change every time that you're in.
Well, so what kind of instruments besides the guitars you have in there? You said banjos.
Yeah.
Yeah, what else would that include?
Yeah, you've got the banjos, especially in the Gibson era, the pre-war stuff, they're not just very expensive. They're very rare. And you ought to see the craftsmanship that's gone into those. I mean, they're all made by hand. The carving, the engravings, the details, it's beyond me. I'm probably the weakest in knowledge in banjos, which I want to get better because
you're a drum guy.
I'm a drum guy, man, you know, but they actually have a drum head on them, so you would think I'd know more. But you have that, and then you've got, you know, the Lloyd Lohr, for instance, was a gentleman that worked with Gibson for a few years, and he was revered as the best wood maker or instrument maker out of wood of anybody that had ever been in America. And so he has this long legacy, and he only made a few instruments for Gibson. He was a fairly unstable guy, from according to documents. But the Lloyd Lohr instruments, for instance, are extremely rare. He made four things. He made an L5 acoustic guitar. He made a mandolin, a mandocello, and a mandola. And so he made a quartet of instruments. So the only thing we don't have is the mandocello right now, but we've got the other three. They're 1924, all out of Brazilian rosewood and other woods that he handcrafted himself. For instance, Bill Monroe was very famous for playing his Lloyd Lohr mandolin on stage, and it's at the Country Music Hall of Fame.
Okay.
And it has obviously significant provenance, but any of those instruments that you see that are Lloyd Lohr's are just incredible for the, you know, I guess the bluegrass enthusiast. And so we have the trio. The coolest thing about the trio is that they were all signed, completed on the same day.
Wow.
So all three instruments.
Gosh.
That's pretty cool in 1924.
That's really cool.
It is really cool.
So where's the fourth one at?
I don't know. They only made nine mandocellos.
Nine total. That's it.
Yeah, they made nine. So we don't have one of those, but we're looking. And so they just don't come on the market very often, and we'd love to have the complete quartet. But even having a trio they made them all in extremely low numbers. For instance, like in 1958, Gibson made an Explorer, which you will see, you know, today because it's been reissued. It's this really ahead of its time guitar. It's very futuristic. They were trying to, you know, capitalize on the space race stuff going on.
Yeah.
And, you know, they made it out of Carina, which is now an illegal wood you can't use anymore. They made 19 Explorers in 1958, and that's it, period. They went away. They didn't sell. Nobody really appreciated the shape of the guitar, and there's one of those down there, too. So it's and, you know, the guys that helped Leo Fender, like Bill Carson and George Fullerton and Leo Fender, they all created the Stratocaster together, because George Fullerton and Bill Carson were both executives with Fender, but they were also great players. And so they created this new guitar called the Stratocaster in 1954. And so, for instance, we've got George Fullerton's 1954 Stratocaster, first year. And we've got, you'll see, I don't remember the exact number, but they made less than 254 Stratocasters. They really didn't introduce them until May of 54. And this gives you the significance of it. I think down there now on display is around 12. One of them is the first custom color Stratocaster ever made, 1954. One is Wanda Jackson's Shell Pink 54 custom color Stratocasters. They did not make any custom colors, hardly at all, in 54. So the guitar was only produced for half a year, but you'll see several other examples. And then George Fullerton's 54 Stratocaster that the Fender employees made for him as a present, which has really unique position on the knobs because he had big hands, so they changed the knobs, the location of the guitar. It has several special appointments. The wood is stupidly insane. So that guitar is one of my favorites, not just because it belonged to the executive Fender, but it's, I mean, you add all the elements together. It belonged to the guy that created the guitar. It's a first year. It's made custom. I mean, it's unbelievable to see by the Fender employees for him as a gift with weird appointments. I mean, it's just a freak in every way, you know. So if you're into this instrument at all, it's a significant part of history.
You know,
it really is. And so there's literally dozens and dozens and dozens of things like that down there. It's unbelievable.
So the negative thing about doing a podcast, you guys can't see the enormous smile on my face. I'm not even a musician.
Yeah.
I just love to hear some of these unique stories. And I was a history major in college, so maybe that's why.
Wow. Yeah.
Just to think about the impact that these have had on the music industry.
Yeah.
And so my guess is that for you, like, to me, the one thing I'm jealous about your job right now is when you do have A-listers come through Chattanooga, and I fully see the Songbirds Museum bringing a lot of A-list musicians through this town now.
Yeah.
Is just to be by their side, to see the look on their face when they see some of these things.
Yeah,
it's got to be unbelievable.
It is unbelievable, man. I tell you, one of the things I witnessed when we did some video with Vince Gill, and we showed him a 64 Sparkle Telecaster that belonged to a guy named Don Rich. Don Rich, if you remember, Hee-Haw was the sideman for Buck Owens. You know, Buck Owens and Roy Clark were the host of Hee-Haw, and I used to watch that thing every weekend. And so this guy, Don Rich, was an incredible vocalist, the ultimate sideman. And we have his very famous 64 Sparkle Telecaster. It was made for him. It has this incredible binding on it. It's just a great guitar. So we took some guitars down to Vince and wanted him to, you know, tell a little bit of story with them. And we knew that he was a big fan of Don Rich. Didn't know how much, but we just knew that he was. And the one thing that Vince tells about that, which was really emotional to watch, because we're in his studio down in Nashville, and we popped out that guitar, and he immediately knew what it was. I mean, within a second. And as he started sharing his story with it, he was, he said he always looked at himself like Don Rich, because Vince was always a guitar player and kind of a great background vocalist for people, and that's what Don did. And then, you know, Don was able to have a little bit of a career himself, but he tragically died in a motorcycle accident, and he died way too young. And so Vince was holding that guitar and was talking about he was kind of raised in Oklahoma City, where a lot of those shows were actually shot at that time. He didn't realize that, you know, but as his dad, he said, was doing a little class reunion, and they were going to do a Hee-Haw skit on there. And, you know, and he said, he asked his dad, he goes, "Hey, Dad, I want to be in your play for your class reunion." He goes, "Well, son, what could you be?" And he goes, "I could be," I'd like to be Don Rich. And then he continues to say that his father let him, and he goes, and we sing and played the song Buckaroo. And Buck Owens' band used to be called the Buckaroos. That was the name of his band. And when Vince says, and to think about it, that the song I was playing was played on this guitar, and he got very emotional on camera. And, he couldn't complete it. Matter of fact, it makes me emotional thinking about watching the video, because I was there when it happened, and I've seen the video, and it evokes emotion every time because it was so legitimate.
Yeah.
To think that these guitars can evoke that kind of emotion from a multiple Grammy Award winner, a guy that's got all the success in the world, you know, his wife has all the success in the world, and, you know, it was just unbelievable to see him be, you know, impressed to emotion by a guitar, because it spoke to him. And, you know, I want to do that a lot. The takeaway is, through all my trials and tribulations, man, music has somehow become the catalyst that created the common denominator, if you will, with a lot of people. And if I'd have given it up, if I hadn't pursued it, if I hadn't stuck with it, you know, then some of these relationships probably wouldn't have established. And so it's been a very important part of my life. And if I can be the inspiration with these instruments to anybody to say, hey, look, you know, music means a lot, whether it's writing a song or whether it's listening and supporting, whether it's getting the guitar back out from underneath the bed, whether it's, getting your grandpa's guitar that maybe you inherited that you haven't opened up in a while. Why don't you open that thing up and look at it and give it a little love and take a moment. And, you know, I don't know, man, it's all about emotion. I think that's what music is. That's the reason it makes us feel good or sad or glad or whatever, you know, makes us drive fast or makes us drive slow or makes us cry, you know. And if I can be a contributor with this place to kind of evoke that emotion, that's what it's about, you know.
Well, I know you said you in the green room, you guys plan on booking some shows. And so I'm really interested to hear if you guys have already booked a few and who are the artists you have coming in for that.
Yeah, we have booked a few. And to be honest, the way it works is we have the green room area that we can do shows in, but we've built the museum and designed it so the timeline section stays in place, but all the other cases are movable as well. So we have two areas that we can do shows in. Just all depending on the time. But it's not just shows, it's private events or anything like that anybody wants to do, because we want to make this available. I mean, it's a heck of a backdrop. But, yeah, we've got some things coming up. April 4th from 7:30 to 9:30, we have the California Guitar Trio, which is just an incredible group of guys that have – I think they're celebrating 18 years together. Three acoustic musicians that are just absolutely unbelievable. April 7th from 7 to 9, we have Kevin Kinney from Driving and Crying that's going to come up and do an acoustic show for us, which will be unbelievable. April 20th, we've got Michael McCauley and Friends, which is a classical guitarist, award-winning classical guitarist. He'll be there at 7:30. And then April 21st is one of our big ones. We have Dick Dale. Now, if you don't know Dick Dale, you need to Google the name, because he is the king of surf guitar. I mean, he's the one that made that guitar sound, that California surf guitar sound. He's got basically the guy that's credited with innovating it. And matter of fact, I was reading about him. In the early 50s, Leo gave him a Stratocaster and said, hey, just go play the heck out of it and beat it to death and tell me what you think about it. You know, so he was very instrumental, no pun intended, and in the Fender Stratocaster. And we actually have one of his personal guitars down there. He's a left-handed guy. He's incredible. That's April 21st. And May 7th, there's a pretty big one here as well. We have Tommy Manuel coming down, which Tommy is revered to be one of the best acoustic guitar performers in the world. Him and my buddy Dual Dykes and Wesley Crider, even a local guy, are just all incredible acoustic guitar players. But Tommy Emmanuel is coming down. We're just announcing that one on May 7th. But you can go to our website or social media. Our website is Songbirds Guitars. It's both plural.com, songbirdsguitars.com, or go to our Facebook page and see some of these things. Now, the great thing about these shows is that you get to see them in a really intimate setting. So it's very unique. You're going to be surrounded by history and listen to some of the guys that created part of that history in a really unbelievably unique setting at our space. And so I'd love to have everybody come down and see it.
Well, and so you guys are open right now.
We are. We're open right now. Yeah, we are. We've actually opened on February 13th for a soft launch. And I think by the time this goes out, we will be officially open with a grand opening event was the past week.
Yeah, so, unfortunately, yeah. This will air after March 11th. But on March 11th, they have a huge street festival happening on Station Street to celebrate the opening of Songbirds Guitar Museum. All right, Johnny. Well, thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure, man. Thanks for the opportunity.
Absolutely. Thank you so much to Johnny Smith for joining us to share more about the museum. Hopefully after that you're inspired to go see this collection for yourself and walk through the history of one of the great cultural artifacts of the last century. You can learn more about the museum at songbirdsguitars.com, or you can just stop by and visit them on Station Street in Southside, part of the Chattanooga Choo Choo. Thank you to our studio sponsor, the Lamp Post Group. You can learn more about them at lamppostgroup.com. Their newest project, the Tomorrow Building, is now open. So if you're looking for a new and innovative place to live downtown, or if you know someone moving to Chattanooga and looking for a place in the Innovation District, have them check out the Tomorrow Building at tomorrowbuilding.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, then please leave us a rating or review on iTunes, or share this episode with a friend. Also, if you haven't seen it yet, please go online and check out the new website. And there you can find this episode or any of our previous episodes. So thank you all for being here. I hope you have a great day, and we'll see you again next week.